The sermon is titled, How to Have Successful, Lasting Marriages. How to Have Successful, Lasting Marriages. You know, every marriage I have ever attended, as a witness, as a participant, or as the one who might have even conducted it, every marriage included a promise by both the bride and the bridegroom to love his or her mate until death. I don't think I've ever heard the bride or the bridegroom say, no, I refuse to state that. I refuse to love my mate until he or she dies. And I wouldn't think that the minister would have performed such a marriage if the bride or the bridegroom or both would have said that. But you see, in effect, some couples, if not many, when they entered the marriage relationship, had reservations. They didn't really believe that it would last until the remainder of their natural lives. And let me just say as an introductory comment that herein lies a reason why marriages don't last. Now, I don't say that there are not legitimate reasons, biblical reasons for divorce. There are. But I do say, don't expect your marriage to end in divorce. Don't enter a marriage with the thought of divorce if it doesn't work out. Make it work. Endure trials and hardship together. So you are becoming one in marriage. Inseparable. Now don't look at the abominable examples of Hollywood celebrities. Movie stars, TV stars, singers, performers. You never seem to know whether they are married, whether they are divorced, whether they are separated, to whom they are married, what their present status is, who are making a mockery out of marriage. Go to Las Vegas, getting married there, having the marriage annulled the next day. Who are marrying, getting divorced, getting married to the same former partner again, getting divorced again, and on it goes. When you get married, when you are married, don't leave yourself a way out. Which means no prenuptial agreements. No separate bank accounts. Have nothing dividing you. You see, you are becoming one. One body, one spirit, one mind. Notice in Genesis chapter 2, beginning in verse 23, what God said about the first married couple. Genesis chapter 2, beginning in verse 23. First, it is Adam who speaks. And he said, this is now bone of my bones, when he saw Eve, when God presented Eve to him. This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman, or to get it more closely to the Hebrew intent, woman, because she was taken out of man. See, it's a play on words here. And now notice how God continues. Therefore, verse 24, a man shall leave his father and mother and shall join to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. One flesh, a total united body, if you please. Notice in Matthew chapter 19 how Jesus Christ confirms the original intent of that oneness, of that unity, and how he addressed the issue of divorce, which is rampant in this day and age. Matthew 19, beginning in verse 3. The Pharisees also came to him, testing him and saying to him, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for just any reason? Something which was taught at that time. And he answered and said to them in verse 4 of Matthew 19, have you not read that he who made them at the beginning made them male and female? And said, for this reason a man shall leave his father and mother, and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So then they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let not man separate. And they said to him, yeah, but Moses, or why then did Moses command to give a certificate of divorce and to put her away? And he said to them, verse 8, Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts, permitted you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it was not so. The purpose of marriage was not to get divorced. Now, of course, Christ goes on to explain there are reasons for divorce. He gives one. Paul later gives another one. But that is not the ideal situation. You see, married people are supposed to stay together. Marriages are for life. Marriages are to be worked out. How can marriages work out? Now, I will include in the sermon some personal experiences and some personal examples. But that doesn't mean by any stretch of the imagination that I am the perfect expert here who has done all these things, which I'm going to tell you now, which you should be doing based on God's words. And some of you who know me may say, oh yeah, but you haven't done that. I've seen you not doing that. Yes, you probably are right. Because you see, I am not the perfect expert, but at the same time, I believe going through life and having learned from mistakes, it might be helpful for you perhaps to hear some of those. The first point I like to stress today is, in order to make your marriage work, express love. Express love. There's a very interesting little scene in the famous musical Fiddler on the Roof. Here is the husband, Anatevka, the milkman. And he asks his wife, do you love me? And the wife answers, I've been with you for 24 years. I've brought up your children. And the man says, yeah, but do you love me? And the wife responds, I lived with you all these years. I've been through a lot of tests and predicaments. And Anatevka asks, yeah, but do you love me? It's an interesting little episode. You know, it shows that both should express to each other that they love each other. And they must do so often. In the Song of Solomon, about half of the expressions of love come from the man, and the other half come from the woman. Well, we turn to the Song of Solomon. It's actually right before the book of Isaiah in the Old Testament. Let me just give you a little bit of a background regarding that book, that Song of Solomon, because it's a very special love song. It actually means the song of highest perfection. The song of highest perfection. King Solomon wrote 1,005 songs, but this is the only one which has been preserved in the Bible. And yes, it might very well have spiritual, figurative meaning. It might very well describe the relationship between Christ and his church, as some suggest. At the same time, it cannot be understood just on that level alone. It clearly has to be understood quite literally. There are at least 10 attempts how to understand the song. One way is looking at it that it's describing King Solomon and his love towards his bride and his wife, Shulamite. Then there's another interpretation, describing the scenes of a marriage of a husband and a wife and just comparing the man with the king, King Solomon. Then there's an interpretation saying that the song describes a conversation between husband and wife or bride and bridegroom on the day of their wedding. And then there are other attempts to interpret that song, but regardless, I'd like you to notice some of the beautiful expressions and feelings of love toward each other, which you can find in this song. For instance, in Song chapter 4 and verse 9, I just called the Song of Solomon now Song. So Song 4, 9, we read, and this is the bridegroom speaking, the man speaking, the husband speaking, "You have ravished my heart, my sister, my spouse. You have ravished my heart with one look of your eyes." Notice he's calling his bride, his wife, my sister. Now, this doesn't mean, of course, that he was actually marrying his sister, because that would be prohibited under the law. Now, he is comparing her with his sister, showing the closeness, a close relationship existing between husband and wife, bride and bridegroom. The NASB translates this verse, "You have made my heart beat faster with a single glance of your eyes." A very nice, romantic way of expressing love towards, in this case, the wife. Notice Song chapter 6 and verse 3. Song 6 and verse 3. Again, the Shulamite, the bride, is saying, "I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine. I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine. A married couple belongs together, and nothing should change that." Notice Song 8 and verse 7. Song 8 and verse 7. And notice this beautiful expression of true love. "Many waters cannot quench love, nor can the floods drown it. If a man would give for love all the wealth of his house, it would be utterly despised." Showing again that love, true love, is priceless, cannot be bought, cannot be paid for. Brethren, we live today in a world without natural affection. The Bible has prophesied that clearly in 2 Timothy 3 and verse 3, and you don't need to turn there, in the Authorized Version, in the end time, people won't have any natural affection for each other. And that is one reason why marriages fail. In order for marriages to succeed, we must have natural affection for each other, including romantic love, including kissing our mates often. Notice in Song chapter 1 and verse 2. Song chapter 1 and verse 2. Here the bride, the wife, is saying, "Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is better than wine." In order to have a successful marriage, we have to express our love towards our partner. Now, how do we do that? Husbands, you express your love towards your life, towards your wife, through loving leadership. And wives, you express your love towards your husbands by submitting to the loving leadership. Now, that's easy said, but not easy done. I put a few words in here. Loving leadership. Expressing your love through loving leadership. Submitting to loving leadership. The man should lead, but he shouldn't domineer. The wife should submit to the lead of the husband, but at the same time, and that's very important, both should submit to each other. You might look at this later in Ephesians 5, verse 21. Submit to each other, it says, in the fear of the Lord. Ephesians 5 is a very interesting chapter. I may talk about it later and quote some of the statements, but it says in there that husbands are to love their wives. And wives are to encourage and to inspire their husbands while respecting them. Respecting the husband. Now, you see, a husband doesn't lead properly, when he looks at matters just strictly from his point of view. It means then that the man should listen to his wife. Mr. Armstrong, who was the late pastor general of the Worldwide Church of God, once told the ministry, "If I find out any of you men belittling your wives, you are going to be out of a job." He didn't like husbands belittling their wives, and if you have read his autobiography, you will find an episode there where he was very strongly supporting and defending his wife, and she was attacked by somebody else. That means for us husbands to value our wife's input, which means nothing can be more degrading for a wife than to be neglected by the husband, as if her opinion doesn't count. The flip side of the coin simply is a husband has to involve his wife in marriage affairs. He must let her know what's going on, where papers are, what bills to pay, what bank accounts exists, and on and on and on it goes. When it comes to husbands and wives, in order to make a marriage work, they have to both inspire confidence and courage in each other. They are to look for the good, for the positive in their mates, to concentrate on that, tell their mates how much they appreciate those qualities, praise them, rather than consistently criticizing them. Now, that's easy to do. I mean, the consistently criticizing aspect. We've all done it. We must not do it, though. It has been rightly said that there is a good woman behind every good man. Guess why that is? It says in God's Word in 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 7 that the man should live with a wife according to knowledge, according to understanding. That means he needs to know how to dwell with his wife. He shouldn't try to enforce his tastes on his newly wed wife. Now, there have been cases, and you might have seen some of those, where a woman would look and act totally different within 6 months of marriage. The man had tried to remake her into the kind of woman that he thought would please him, but in the process he had destroyed her. He had destroyed her self-respect. He had destroyed her drive. It's important in this regard that couples don't act too hastily, that they don't fall in love before they are ready to get married. Otherwise, if they get married before they have known each other well enough, just because, let's say, of a feeling of romantic or sexual arousal, the husband will try to change his wife according to his liking. Notice what we read again in Song chapter 2 and verse 7. And it's actually here the bride, the wife, who is speaking. Song 2 and verse 7. "I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or by the does of the field, do not stir up nor awaken love until it pleases." And that's repeated several times in chapter 3 and verse 5, in chapter 8 and verse 4. And most translations, modern translations, have here, "Don't awaken love until it is ready." Until it is ready. Which means, get to know each other before you get married so you know what person you are marrying and whether you are willing to stay with that person for the rest of your life, even if that person doesn't change. Don't expect change. Don't demand change. Accept it gladly when it comes, but be willing to live with your mate even if there is no change at all. If you can't do that, don't get married. Mr. Armstrong also said one other interesting point, or made one interesting point. He said once, "I would never marry a woman who can't wear the pants, but I never would like to be married to one who does." Think about it that. See, the man is the leader, supposed to be leading, and the wife is supposed to be submitting to the, again, loving leadership of the husband. Both, or neither, I should say, should insist on just having it their way. A successful marriage hinges on the willingness to submit one to another, as I said earlier, in the fear of God. The husband is told to love his wife. That includes in leadership. A husband who dictates his wishes to his wife, and that might sound big and bold, but I like to say it. A husband who dictates his wishes to his wife doesn't really love her. Why is that? Because love is outgoing concern for the welfare and the benefit of the other person. Which means a husband must be willing to forego his desires for the benefit of his mate if that's necessary. Christ loved his church so much that he was willing to die for it. In the same way, the husband must love his wife, Paul says. Notice in Genesis chapter 29, it's a beautiful example of Jacob's love for his wife-to-be, Rachel. Genesis 29 and verse 20. Genesis 29 and verse 20. So Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed only a few days to him because of the love he had for her. See, he was willing to wait 7 years because that's how long he had to work in order to be able to marry to Rachel. But he loved her so much that it didn't matter. He was willing to wait, is my point. Notice also in Genesis chapter 3 and verse 16 what God told Eve after Adam and Eve had sinned against God by not obeying him in what he had told them to do. He says in Genesis 3 and verse 16, to the woman he said, I will greatly multiply your sorrow and your conception. In pain you shall bring forth children. Your desire shall be for your husband. Notice this. Your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. So the woman's desire would be for her husband. But what about the husband? Is this a one-way street? Notice Song 7. I hope you kept your finger there in the book of Song, because we'll get back to it throughout the sermon. Song 7 and verse 10. Here again, the bride, the wife, is speaking. I am my beloved's, and his desire is toward me. So not only is it the desire of the wife for the husband, but it's also the desire of the husband towards the wife. Whatever bridge there might have been was now crossed. No longer any separation whatsoever. It's a mutual desire, because after all, the two have become one. How else are we supposed to express our love towards our mate? We express our love towards our mate through sex. Now I got, of course, the attention of everyone. Some can't wait to hear what I have to say. Some may think I'd rather skip that one. But I won't, because it's in the Bible. It's very important that we understand this properly. Let us not forget, as a married couple, we are to love each other sexually. Barring some extraordinary circumstances where that might not be possible because of physical problems or ideas. But normally speaking, that's what we are supposed to be doing. Notice Proverbs chapter 5. And let's also notice a little bit about that the Bible is not at all as coy or as shy as some want it to be. The Bible is very plain when it comes to this aspect of what we are discussing now. Proverbs 5 and verse 15. Notice what is being stated here. Drink water from your own cistern and running water from your own well. See, the emphasis is, of course, having this relationship between your husband and your wife. Don't go outside that relationship. And then he goes on to say, in verse 19, as a loving deer and a graceful doe, let her breasts satisfy you at all times, and always be enraptured, and the literal here is intoxicated, with her love. But you cannot improve your sex life if you don't love your mate with godly love of treating the other better than yourself, of having romantic love for your mate, of having a deep, friendly relationship with your mate, and I will talk about that in a moment. But right now, let's emphasize that God created sex. Now, some will tell you that is a very dirty thing which somehow got into the world through Satan. That's absolutely wrong. God created sex. He said it's good in marriage. Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 4. Hebrews 13 and verse 4. Now, the fact that the Authorized Version and the New King James Bible was trying to cloud the meaning here doesn't say that in the Greek it's not stated very bluntly. Let me just read to you how it's written here in the New King James. It says, marriage is honorable among all, and the bed undefiled, but fornicators and adulterers God will judge. Again, showing the relationship inside the marriage as opposed to a relationship outside the marriage. But the interesting thing here, the word bed, the way that's translated, in the Greek the word is koite, K-O-I-T-E, from which is derived our word coitus, or cohabitation. It's very clear what this is talking about, isn't it? If the translators would have made it a little bit more accurate. Notice again, Paul is addressing the same issue in 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 3. 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 3. I remember recently somebody gave a sermonette saying that we try to avoid sometimes statements specifically written in the Song of Solomon. Well, I come to some of those in a moment. I'm not shy about that at all. 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 3, notice it. Let the husband render to his wife the affection due to her. Now again, affection is not the best translation. The NASB says, let the husband fulfill his duty to his wife, and likewise also the wife to her husband. It goes on to say in verse 4, the wife does not have authority over her own body. You notice what this is talking about here. But the husband does. And likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. And if there's any doubt as to what Paul is talking about, notice verse 5. Do not deprive one another, except with consent for a time, that you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer, and come together again. So that Satan does not tempt you because of your lack of self-control, the warning being that you are not tempted to go outside the marriage relationship. That's the context here. But Paul is very clear, is he not, as to what he is addressing. Let's go back to the Song of Solomon. And as I said earlier, you cannot just look at this in a spiritual, figurative, elusive way. Solomon knew quite well what he was writing here. Notice Song chapter 4 and verse 16. Here is the bride, the wife, speaking to the husband. Song 4 and verse 16. Awake, O north wind, and come, O south. Blow upon my garden, that its spices may flow out. Let my beloved come to his garden and eat its present fruits. Chapter 5, verse 1. Hear now the beloved. The husband is saying, I have come to my garden, my sister, my spouse. I have gathered my myrrh with my spice. I have eaten my honeycomb with my honey. I have drunk my wine with my milk. And now, as it should rightly be and correctly translated or emphasized, it is now God who is saying, in the latter part of chapter 5, verse 1, "Eat, O friends, drink, yes, drink deeply, O beloved ones." Or as the New English Bible has here, "Eat, friends, and drink until you are drunk with love." Now again, this is very clear what is being expressed here. And it's nothing wrong with it whatsoever. It's good insight, the marriage relationship. Now, how else can you express your love? One important point to emphasize is that we have to express our love towards our mates through peacemaking. Peacemaking. You know, there always will be problems in life. And this includes problems in marriage. If you think you will have a marriage which will have no problem whatsoever, everything is smooth sailing, you'll have surprise coming. It's not working that way. Now, some marriages have been or are better than others, and some may be even close as perfect as they could get, but there are still problems, regardless. The question is, how do you deal with them? You see, I've heard young people say, "I will never act in marriage the way I see my dad or my mom act." I've said it. I noticed my mom and my dad doing things, and I said, "Oh, I would never do that." Sure enough, the time came, I didn't. Those who say, "I will never act that way," will act exactly that way when the time comes. Now, that doesn't mean that these problems, if there are problems, can't be overcome. But you've got to be aware of the problem. It will happen that way, I guarantee it. You see, Abraham lied to others when he said that his wife was actually his sister. And then you read that Isaac, his son, did exactly the same thing. He also lied about his wife, saying she was his sister. If we all would act in every case as we ought to, there would never be a problem in marriage between husband and wife. But the fact is, we don't always act in the way we ought to. The real question then is, how do we react when misunderstandings or challenges occur? And here's a clue. Christ said, "Blessed are the peacemakers." It takes effort. I'd like to read to you an interesting scripture in the book of Jeremiah, chapter 29. In this particular passage, Jeremiah chapter 29, and in verse 11, God is speaking to Old Testament Israel. But you also know that in Old Testament times, God was pictured as being married to the nation of Old Testament Israel. So in other words, there's also a marriage relationship involved. And let's now apply what God is saying here to Old Testament Israel to us today as husbands and wives, and apply it as the husband speaking to the wife. And notice what it says here. God is saying, "For I know the thoughts," Jeremiah 29 and verse 11, "I know the thoughts that I think toward you, says the Lord, thoughts of peace and not of evil, to give you a future and a hope." In other words, if the husband thinks and speaks that way, to think in terms of how to create peace, to think in terms of how he can give his wife a future and a hope, the hope that the marriage is going to last in a happy way, then it's a big step forward towards a lasting, peaceful, and happy relationship. You see, sometimes a mate may have a bad day. He or she may be in a bad mood. It happens. You see, that wouldn't be the time, that wouldn't be the best time to unload on the person. Rather, it would be better to wait until the mood has gotten better. Then talk, if you must. But not before then. And when you talk, just don't go back to Adam and Eve. In other words, don't bring up problems from the past which should have been buried and forgotten. That's not the way to be a peacemaker. Notice in Proverbs chapter 10, and even though these are scriptures which talk about our relationship towards other people in general, I like to apply them here to a marriage situation. They are not limited to a marriage situation, but they most certainly would be included. Proverbs chapter 10 and verse 12. Proverbs chapter 10 and verse 12. Hatred stirs up strife, but love covers all sins. Rather than resurrecting them all when you have an argument with your mate, no, you leave covered what should be covered. If that's not the problem you are dealing with right now, don't bring these past things up. Notice chapter 16 and verse 27. Proverbs 16 and verse 27. Notice what it says here. An ungodly person digs up evil. Evil which is supposed to be buried, forgotten. No, but he digs it up. And it is on his lips like a burning fire. In other words, he can't stop talking about it. Can't stop forgetting it. Has to be raised up. Has to be dug up again. That's not the way to become a peacemaker. Chapter 17 and verse 9. Chapter 17 and verse 9. He who covers a transgression seeks love. How to express love to your mate? By being willing to cover a transgression, not making a big deal out of it. But notice, but he who repeats a matter separates friends. And as I said earlier, husband and wife are supposed to be close friends. So this can separate the friendship of a married couple. Be very careful that you don't dig up evil and dig up transgressions which should have been buried and left in the past. Chapter 19 and verse 11. Chapter 19 and verse 11 of the book of Proverbs, it says, the discretion of a man makes him slow to anger, and his glory is to overlook a transgression. Be willing to overlook it. If it's not a big deal which has to be taken care of, because after all, this is one way of making peace. But if you have to talk, don't say too much, even when you have to limit yourself to the quote-unquote current situation. Let's go back to Proverbs chapter 10 and verse 19. Proverbs chapter 10 and verse 19. It says, in the multitude of words, sin is not lacking. So even if the problem is a problem which has to be addressed, if you keep going on and on and on, then in the multitude of words, sin isn't lacking. But he who restrains his lips, limits himself or herself to just dealing with the problem at hand, that person is wise. And then also notice chapter 15 and verse 28. Another important aspect as to how one can become a peacemaker. Before we speak, it says, the heart of the righteous studies how to answer. Thinks about it first. How should I respond? How should I say these things? What should I say? But the mouth of the wicked just pours forth evil, just says whatever's in his or her heart. And of course, that can create a lot of problems. And finally, in this concept, in this context, we are to speak friendly, not harshly, not in a hurtful way. Even if we say the things we need to say, there are certain ways how to say them. And again, yours truly is most certainly not perfect in that regard either. But notice, nevertheless, we have to point these things out and we have to all work on doing it better. Proverbs 12 and verse 18. There is one who speaks like the piercings of a sword. You know, if you think of a piercing of a sword, that hurts, doesn't it? And sometimes words can be that way. But the tongue of the wise, the one who has studied first how to answer, the tongue of the wise promotes health, peace, tranquility, happiness. And finally, Proverbs 15 and verse 1. Proverbs 15 and verse 1. It says, a soft answer turns away wrath. If there is a wrathful situation, a situation where the tempers fly high, it says a harsh word stirs up anger, that makes it even worse. But a soft answer turns away wrath if it's done in the right way at the right time. So we are expressing our love towards each other, and husbands and wives are expressing their loves towards each other through peacemaking. But, you know, before problems start, it's better, of course, to see to it that they don't occur to begin with. And so we are to also express our love through preventing problems from occurring. Again, I started with the peacemaking first because the lesson of life is that many times there are problems. But we also need to concentrate on seeing that they don't occur to begin with. So we have to express our love, and that's how we do it, to our mates by seeing that problems don't occur in the first place. And one way of doing that is when both husbands and wives respect each other's wishes and preferences, and when they express good manners to each other and in public, especially if that's important to the couple or to one of them. Now, in my notes here, I put all kinds of funny faces, because what I'm going to say now, I know how my wife's going to look at me. But I'm speaking from experience, you see. For instance, this does include cleanliness. I saw my dad working in the yard, and I just say this for a humorous anecdote. And then after he was done working in the yard, he would come in with his dirty shoes on. And I heard my mom several times say, don't do that, specifically once she had cleansed the house. Now I said, I'll never do that. Well, it did happen from time to time, you know, thinking about other things, not really concentrating on what kind of shoes I had on. And so I come into the house after my wife had just cleansed it. And so, of course, you know, walking with my dirty shoes on the nice clean carpet. Or I sometimes may forget after I shave, and I still shave with the old-fashioned way, not with this electric stuff, but I still have shaving cream I use. And so I may not necessarily clean up the bathroom after shaving all the time, and my wife doesn't like that. That's why I put the funny faces here. But before we go too much overboard, sometimes my wife reorganizes my books and my files. And that is also something which has to be done in a very careful way, specifically if I can't find the material afterwards anymore. The point being, just consider the wishes and preferences of your mates. And one thing, frankly, even though I kind of spoke about this a little bit humorously when it comes to cleanliness, it is important because God expects of us to be clean, physically as well as spiritually. Notice in Revelation chapter 19, and I realize, of course, that these are, in a sense, spiritual attributes, but it's still interesting how God describes them. Revelation 19 and verse 8. Revelation chapter 19 and verse 8. This is the wife, the bride of Jesus Christ. And it says in verse 8 of Revelation 19, and to her it was granted to be arrayed in fine linen, clean and bright. And then here comes the spiritual application, for the fine linen is the righteous acts of the saints. But nevertheless, Christ points out that is a clean and bright garment. Why is that stated, if it doesn't make any difference to God whether it's clean or whether it's dirty? Even the armies in heaven, Revelation 19 and verse 14, coming to this earth, it says they are clothed in fine linen, white and clean, following Christ on white horses. And then they are going to get engaged in warfare. And then, of course, for a while, the linens won't be that clean anymore. But even when they go into war, so to speak, it's still clean. Something which is emphasized also in the Old Testament. Numbers chapter 19, notice this. Numbers 19 and verse 19. Now, it's of course important to consider the right occasion. I wouldn't recommend that when you go out and you clean your yard or you cut your yard that you do this with a suit and with a tie on. I mean, I'm not talking about that. But I would say, you know, when you travel, let's say, in an airplane, I don't see any reason, like I had to observe recently some people who are traveling and they have the most dirty clothes on you can imagine. There's no reason for that. There's no reason for that. Numbers 19 at verse 19. It says, the clean person shall sprinkle the unclean on the third day and on the seventh day, And on the seventh day he shall purify himself, wash his clothes, and bathe in water, and at evening he shall be clean. Now, of course, here was ritual cleansing. Understand that. It had to do with this person touching a dead body. But there are also, obviously, here some physical aspects involved. Otherwise, God wouldn't have done it that way. It had to do with, you know, staying away from whatever sickness there might have been. And also notice in Deuteronomy chapter 23 how God emphasizes cleanliness, something we all should learn from and should apply in our lives. Deuteronomy 23, let's start reading at verse 9. And here again we're talking about an army in Old Testament times. When the army goes out against your enemies, then keep yourself from every wicked thing. Deuteronomy 23, verse 10. And if there is any man among you who becomes unclean by some occurrence in the night, then he shall go outside the camp. He shall not come inside the camp. But it shall be, when evening comes, that he shall wash with water, and when the sun sets, he may come into the camp. And also you shall have a place outside the camp where you may go out. And you shall have an implement among your equipments, and when you sit down outside, you shall dig with it and turn and cover your refuse. It's interesting that even today you might observe dogs when they go out and do their business, then they use their little legs to try to cover whatever they did. Interesting that God put that instinct into them. It's instinct because, you see, sometimes they would do it on the street where there is no dirt, they still would do it. And so it goes on to say here in verse 14, "For the Lord your God walks in the midst of your camp to deliver you and give your enemies over to you. Therefore your camp shall be holy, that he may see no unclean thing among you and turn away from you." So it is important to God that we live clean lives, physically as well as spiritually. And it is expressing love towards our mates if we do that. Now, we can also express and should express our love towards our mate when we resolve problems. One way of resolving it, we already discussed, by being peacemakers. But there are other ways. For instance, it says in the book of Colossians, chapter 3 and verse 19, again a scripture you might just want to jot down, "Husbands, don't be bitter against your wives." In other words, control your tongues. And most importantly, don't let the sun go down on your wrath. Get things settled day by day. You see, nothing can be more destructive to a successful marriage or to a successful personal relationship than lingering, unresolved problems. I remember how I was angry with my wife just once, and I wouldn't want to talk to her for a while. But you know what? It ate me up. It actually ate me up. I felt bad. I felt so bad that I had to call her, had to tell her that I loved her, that I felt bad about the situation, that we should forget about this petty misunderstanding, because in most cases it's just tiny little unimportant things, but being blown out of proportion, they can become big issues. And I remember how my wife readily and gladly responded in kind. The point is, let's not delay reconciliation. Let's not delay working out misunderstandings. Well, let's pick the right time. Don't do it when your mate is in a bad mood, as we discussed. But once the air is clean in that regard, let's get to it. I read several years ago, and I don't know and I don't remember where and when, in a novel, in a story, about an interesting little aspect of how a lingering problem can create a big one. And in the story, a problem was compared with a little brick. And it's just a brick at a time, and you know, you put the brick down, and there comes another unresolved problem, and you add it to the brick, and then sooner or later you have a brick wall, and the brick wall is getting bigger and bigger and higher until you have one partner standing on this side of the wall, and the other partner standing on the other side of the wall, and the wall has gotten so high that you can't even look at each other anymore. I thought this was a very good parallel, because that's what's happening with unresolved problems. One leads to the next until finally you have a mountain you can't climb over anymore. I'm talking about communication problems. See, communication problems are, I would say, the biggest reason for failing marriages. I remember when my wife and I had a misunderstanding. It might have been the same one, because, you know, that's just the one. But we had a misunderstanding. And I tried to withdraw into my little private shell. And she said to me, "Talk to me." And that helped. And we did talk. And let me also say that we might not have had a perfect marriage so far, because I don't believe anybody has, or anybody will, in this life. We have been married for now over 28 and a half years. And as I pointed out earlier, divorce has never, ever entered our minds. You see, it was never an option to consider. We were in it for life. And it might sound corny. I heard the singer of the Creedence Clearwater Revival group, you might recall that, it's an old one, but he gave a nice performance one time, and he just sang a song. He accompanied himself on the guitar, and he saw his wife in the audience. And he said to her, "I wrote that song for my wife, because I love my wife." It was a very touching, moving statement, and I like to say that I love my wife, and she loves me. And as I said, this sounds pretty corny, perhaps, but I wouldn't want to have it any other way. And with that kind of an attitude, you can solve problems if you don't look for a way out. But don't ever delay overcoming your anger. That applies to marriage. That applies to child rearing. Now, I'm not talking about child rearing here per se, because that may be a sermon I want to give in the future. But just to say that don't ever punish your child, spank your child, when you are angry. Because, you see, you may not control yourself. Now, spanking is not wrong. The Bible makes this very clear. But physically hurting, or in a sense abusing your child, is. It should never be. That should never happen. And if you are angry, then that might happen. So it's very important to control your anger. Don't do anything while you are angry or while you are impatient. Don't do it to your children. Don't do it to your husband or your wife. We have read that we are supposed to give our maid a soft answer, which turns away wrath. You see, it takes two to fight. It takes only one to give. Now, rather than expecting your maid to do something for you, try to do it yourself. And in the process, try to do something for her or him as well. Another important key of having, granting, lasting, successful, happy marriages is by expressing your love to your mate by studying the Bible together at times and by praying together at times. We read in God's Word that we don't love God if we don't love our brethren. And how much more does that apply to the closest person we have on earth, our mate? You see, husbands and wives, as we have already seen, are described in the Bible as brother and sister, showing the close relationship they should have. And they're also described as the closest of friends. See, God called Abraham his friend. Our husband, our wife, should be our closest friend. And so notice in 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 7 what is stated here, because praying together and reading the Bible together at times can deepen that friendship between us. 1 Peter 3 and verse 7, it says, "Husbands, likewise, dwell with them with understanding, giving honor to the wife as to the weaker vessel, and as being heirs together of the grace of life, that your prayers may not be hindered." Now, even though this is an accurate translation from the Greek, the concept expressed might very well be, as many German translations have it here, like the Luther Bible, they say that you are praying together, may not be hindrance, or that your mutual prayer may not be hindrance. That might very well be included. And I recall that when my wife and I had these very rare problems on occasion, these misunderstandings, we would sit or kneel down together and pray about the problem first before we would try to address them. It has helped. It will help you. Praying together is a very good key of expressing love towards your mates. Now that brings me to the next point. Expressing love to your mates can be done, should be done, must be done by never rejecting God in your marriage. Now you see, you wouldn't pray to God unless you believe there is a God, obviously. And you wouldn't pray to God unless you believe that your prayer would make a difference. But you still can reject God in your marriage in ways perhaps not thinking about. You know, Adam and Eve did. Adam and Eve rejected God in their marriage. How did they do it? They did it when they refused to eat from the tree of life and when they ate from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil instead. Why? Because the tree of life, amongst other things, represented the gift of the Holy Spirit, which is the way of love and of give. The tree of the knowledge represented the way of get, the way of the knowledge of this world, which is selfish and based on selfish endeavors. So when Adam and Eve refused to eat from the tree of life and they ate from the tree of knowledge instead, they rejected God. Because you see, God was the author of the way of give. You see, God is love. And it says, God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, so that anyone who believes in him shouldn't perish but have everlasting life. God's way of life is a way of give, not of get. And if we want to have God in our marriages, we have to walk that way of give. And we must never give in order to get. Because once we do that, we already walk the way of get. Just about every marital problem stems from one partner or the other or both trying to get from the other. It's another way of saying nearly all marital problems spring from breaking God's spiritual laws. We must allow God to live in our marriages. If there are problems developing with our mates, we ought to pray first to God, either alone or even, as I said earlier, together, before even trying to solve the problems. Because, you see, we need to have the understanding from God how to deal with it. Otherwise, we might just go about the wrong way. And so we need to pray to God regularly to give us the strength, the ability to fulfill our God-given marital responsibilities, to be loving and kind and considerate toward our mates, to grow in love toward our mates, as well as in the knowledge as to how to behave. Avoid mood swings. Avoid bad attitudes. We just say that bad attitudes toward your mates is like a poison, which, if not rooted out quickly, will destroy, ultimately, the marriage. And that brings me to my final point I'd like to address today. And that is, express love to your mate by always remembering the purpose of marriage. Because a human marriage isn't something which just evolved, which just came into existence somehow by accident. The human marriage, as we have already seen, is something which was designed by God, set in force by God. Why? Because it is the physical pattern of the spiritual marriage between Christ and his church. It's just a pattern. And Christ is treating his church in a certain way, and the church is responding to Christ's lead. And as Christ does that to the church, and as the church is responding to Christ, so the husband should lead his wife and treat his wife in that same way, and the wife should respond to the husband in kind. Now notice in Ephesians chapter 5, I alluded to it several times. Now let's quickly go and read it. Ephesians 5, verses 25 to 27. Here the Apostle Paul makes this point very clear, this analogy between the physical marriage and the spiritual marriage still to come. At least the consummation of it is still to come. Ephesians 5, beginning at verse 25. He says, "Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church." Notice the comparison. "Husbands, love your wife just as Christ loved the church and gave himself for her, that he might sanctify and cleanse her with the washing of water by the word, that he might present her to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she should be holy and without blemish." So we are seeing here that Christ, the husband, is purifying his wife, the church. But you see, it's a two-way street. Christ couldn't purify the church unless the church would respond. And so notice now in 1 John chapter 3 and verse 3, our responsibility towards Christ's purification, if you please. 1 John 3 and verse 3. John just talked about Christ's return and what's going to happen to us when Christ returns, and that we will be changed into glory. And then he says in verse 3 of 1 John 3, "And everyone who has this hope in him purifies himself, just as he, Christ, is pure." So we have a part to play. We purify ourselves. We are letting Christ purifying us by responding to his purification. And so in Revelation chapter 19 and verse 7, we find exactly the same thing. We read verse 8 a few moments ago. Let's read Revelation 19 and verse 7. It says, "Let us be glad and rejoice and give him glory, for the marriage of the Lamb has come, and his wife has made herself ready." So the wife has a part to play, as it is a two-way street, as I said. The husband leads, the wife responds. Christ leads the church got to respond. If the husband doesn't lead, the wife cannot respond. If the husband does lead and the wife doesn't respond, the couple won't still be ready when the big challenges of life occur. It's a two-way street. Now, I have just scratched the surface today of how to have happy marriages. And I haven't even talked about how to have happy families going into child rearing. We have a booklet here. It's called The Keys to Happy Marriages and Families. And if you haven't read it for a while, or if you have never read it, I would strongly recommend you do, because it goes into some of the aspects I have discussed today and in a lot more of aspects. But I want today end with the love chapter from the marriage ceremony. And when we are conducting a marriage, we are going to read that. And I'd like to read it right now to give you a summary of what really we have been discussing today. It says in here, "The essential qualities of a happy and successful marriage are those that express an ever-growing, godly love, which is outgoing concern for the welfare and benefit of the other person." The Apostle Paul described it this way, and I'm quoting from 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verses 4 to 8 in the New International Version. "Love is patient and kind. Love does not envy or boast. Love is not proud or rude. Love is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It does not keep a record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. Love always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Love never fails. As a loving father, God wants to pour out upon us his richest blessings. He wants us to be supremely happy. To that end, He has given us His wonderful gift of marriage.